Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
It's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. Hailed as one of the most important bands in music since the dawn of the rock and roll era, the legendary rock and roll band Chicago has received many honors, including a Grammy, multiple American Music Awards, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, a Chicago street dedicated in their honor, which has record sales topping the 100 million mark, which includes 21 top 10 singles, 5 consecutive number 1 albums, 11 number 1 singles, and 5 gold singles. An incredible 25 of their 36 albums have been certified platinum, and the band has a total of 47 gold and platinum awards. For nearly 50 years, the signature sound of the Chicago horns, their iconic vocalists, and a few dozen of ever-classic songs like 25 or 6 to 4, Make Me Smile, Just You and Me, Saturday in the Park, Beginnings, Hard to Say I'm Sorry, Chicago continues to be true ambassadors for their beloved hometown. The lineup includes original band members Lee on trumpet, James on trombone, Walt on woodwinds, and the original co-founder on vocals and keyboards is our guest tonight, the legendary Robert Lamb. Robert, welcome in, my friend, and congrats on this week's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction.
Thank you so much.
Well, Chicago has been around as long as I've been on the planet Earth, and I was born in 67, but I became a fan about a decade into your history and really rediscovering this amazing sound. Now, as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, you grew up with jazz playing in your home. You sang and played piano in the Brooklyn Heights Choir. You were 15 when you moved to Chicago, attended Chicago Vocational High School and Roosevelt University. What stayed with you all these years that influenced you about the city of Chicago?
My earliest memory is listening to the radio. Listening to the radio while I was going to high school, you know, getting up in the morning and, you know, getting ready to slog down the block over the icy sidewalks to wait for the bus to take me to school. But it's the radio stations in Chicago that struck me as very different than what I listened to in New York. And, of course, I was listening more to music as a teenager. But the variety of music that was and probably still is played on the radio stations in Chicago is varied. It's ethnically different. But there was a lot of jazz. There was a lot of R&B. And, of course, you know, the great top 40 stations at the time.
The WLSs, WCLRs, FYRs.
Yeah, and all of those had a big effect on not only me, but the rest of my co-founders of the band. It was just a very rich place to draw from. Of course, then when the Beatles came to be, that changed everything for anybody who was a musician at the time.
Well, you played and wrote music very early on, and people always ask an artist, who's your inspiration? It was Ray Charles for you.
It was Ray Charles for me. And again, you know, once the Beatles hit, it, the idea that a few guys in a little rock band could write their own songs and play them, that was a big awakening.
Now, at 23, you received a call to pursue your interest in forming a band. How did you come together with Walter, Terry, Danny, Lee, and James to form this rock and soul band that was first called The Big Thing?
I was playing with a couple of smaller bands around the North Side, mostly quartets, you know, guitar, piano, drums, bass. And I, just out of the blue, I received a telephone call one day. And I can't remember if it was Walt or Danny Seraphin. It was one or the other. But it was explained to me the idea of putting together a rock band with horns, and was I interested? And they had heard that I played keyboards, and actually I later heard that they had come to listen to the bands I was playing with at the time, and so I was invited to come and meet them, and was I interested? And I was interested because, you know, it was just I was accustomed to listening to jazz, as you mentioned earlier, from my parents' record collection, and so the idea was fascinating to me.
So when they said horns, it was so unique and different to say horns with a rock and roll band, that right there must have been pretty appealing.
It was, and of course, you know, in R&B, you know, whether it was Wilson Pickett or Sam and Dave or whoever in that day, in R&B, the horns were present in many of the records, and then a couple of the Beatles songs, "Got to Get You Into My Life," particularly, there were horns present. So the Beatles were beginning to use horns, and so I thought this could be very interesting.
Now, you started touring around pretty quickly, and you were playing at clubs like Barnaby's in Chicago, where you also met the lead singer of a band called The Exceptions, and that was Peter, I believe.
Yeah, Peter. The Exceptions were the premier rock band, club band, in those days. Everybody who was a musician or in a band was very aware of them and just awed by the skills that band had in reproducing top 40 hits live on stage.
And you took on Peter. You guys moved kind of to L.A. to kind of, you know, get your name a little bit out there and see some of these other record labels. You were making about $20 a week back then, right?
Well, courtesy of our producer Jimmy Garcia, who was also a Chicago native.
Yeah, and he was with CBS. Yeah.
Yeah. By then, he was a staff producer at CBS and had some success and had some leverage, and. At one of our Midwest dates, Walt Parizader contacted him by the phone and invited him to come and see us and listen to us, and maybe he'd be interested in taking us under his wing. He came, he listened, and he did.
Well, and the big thing, you know, the name of the band, I mean, you were a pretty big group with all the horns and instruments and all the players and so forth, but at some point somebody said, you know, we're going to change the name. Who came up with Chicago Transit Authority?
That was Jimmy Garcia. And later on, of course, while we were recording in New York, working on the first album, a staff member at CBS at Columbia Records came in and listened to some playbacks after the album was pretty well almost finished, and suggested that we shorten the name to Chicago, and that seemed like a logical progression.
Well, you mentioned starting recording your first album in 69, not really having any experience. You guys were doing clubs and stuff, but not really ever being in a recording studio to put that together. That must have been, you know, I have to imagine it was exciting, but I would say nerve-wracking probably as well.
Well, you know, we were just kids, and, you know, we were of the age where many things were new. And we were experiencing virtually everything for the first time. And so walking into a major record label's recording studio, one of several that they had in New York City at the time, was just fascinating. And one of the studios in particular, Studio B on 52nd Street, mm-hmm. was just a huge recording studio and had instruments of all kinds just sort of sitting around or covered up, waiting to be used, including one of the greatest sounding Steinway acoustic grand pianos I had ever heard. Uh-huh. One that we've heard, that we've all heard on many historic recordings, including Chicago's.
Very, very cool. And you know, I know you, you talk about being, you guys were so young. You were writing nonstop. This was a double album, you know, right out of the box. FM radio was just making a splash at the time where Chicago's music was really embraced. But some stations at that time, did they know how to identify what your group was all about because it was such a new and unique sound?
No, I think that then and even now, I think several reasons, I think that Chicago has failed to fall easily into any particular pigeonhole, partly because we were trying to do something different, partly because the songs were coming from several members in the band with differing influences. So it was really sort of hard to categorize Chicago. And then, of course, recording the first several albums, all of them double albums, we sort of didn't know any better that you weren't supposed to do that. But we did have a champion in Jim Garcia who was able to twist a few arms at Columbia Records. And luckily, Clive Davis, who was the head of Columbia Records, was willing to go along based upon success of the first album and the fact that we were really an accomplished performing band right from the get-go.
Well, landed you in Billboard's top 20, so the proof was in the pudding right there. 148 weeks consecutively on the charts. I'd say that's pretty good right out of the box.
I wish we could do it again.
I bet you can. Well, I'll tell you what, we're talking to Robert Lamb of Chicago and his induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we'll have more with him next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Robert Lamb, co-founder of the band Chicago, and his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction coming up this Friday night. So, Robert, how did you approach the songwriting? Do you sit down at a certain time of day and write? You know, some people have a method to their madness. Do you wait for inspiration to put pen to paper? How does that all come about? Because, I mean, you write nonstop.
I have always tended to work sort of sporadically. And of course, once Chicago started touring, I mean, even before the first album, once Chicago started touring, I was not very good at composing on the road. Although I was smart enough to write down ideas, whether they be lyrical or just a melody idea. I was smart enough to make some notes so that when I did get home and I did get to a piano, I had something to start with. But my method has been very slow. I'm not like an Elton John who can just sort of dash off a number of songs in a matter of days. I work slowly, and I rewrite and rewrite and edit and change things as I go, and that has always been the case. Of course, writing for Chicago was a very different matter. It wasn't just writing a song. It was a matter of writing a composition that would include places where the horns could play and the various soloists in the band could play.
But but months after the release of the first album, you went on to work on the second album. That's why I say it was nonstop. I mean, it was every 9 months. I mean, you were writing and writing and while you were on tour doing all of this at the same time. I mean, that's a lot of content to be thrown out there.
I think that when you're young like that and, you know, you're wanting to seek approval, you're young and hungry and lots of energy, I think that's appropriate. I mean, I'm glad that's the way it happened.
Yeah. And just as iconic as of the sound of Chicago, Robert, the logo is so iconic, always dominant on all the covers. Who said, you know what? Because not a lot of bands, especially back then, had like a specific logo that was tied into their brand. You kind of made a brand for yourself with that logo. How did that all come together?
Oh, that was really a sort of a philosophical decision that was very much influenced by Jim Guercio. And we talked a lot about a creative community. We talked a lot about this is the age of the hippie, and communes were happening where people would mm-hmm. sort of step away from the mainstream of society and kind of work together and you know have the focus be on whatever the project was, and in our case it's music. And Guercio's point was that it seemed, at least in rock and roll, that whenever the focus went away from the music and was put upon particular individuals or anything other than music, it was a distraction. And he was right. To this day, in spite of all the fame and all the places that we've played and all the music that people are familiar with, you know, I can still pretty much travel anonymously, and it's really been a great freedom for all of us.
Yeah, I bet. But at the time, you know, you were talking about, you know, what was going on at the time in some of the content. Your political consciousness went back to the late 60s, you know, the uprising in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movements that were happening. You guys had a platform, and you used it.
We did use it, and partly because it was such a cultural change from anything that we had known as younger guys. So once the 60s hit, and the war in Vietnam was basically televised, as were you know, voter registrations in the South, and equal rights, not only for other races, but for women, that was beginning to emerge. I think all of that stuff we sensed, and it was in our faces in the news media, that it was something that was worth talking about, it was worth writing about, even though politically, and socially, at least as far as the things that I wrote, I wasn't particularly conversant with all the issues, but I sensed that we needed to address some of it. So,
yeah, you were talking about what was happening at the time. I mean, it was indicative of the that time in history. Third album was another double album, and then came Chicago at Carnegie Hall, went gold out of the box, and has since been certified for sales of like 2 million copies. This one was a little difficult to release. Was Columbia not willing to flip the bill for production? What was the deal with that? Because that was a great album.
I'm sure they weren't crazy about the idea, but yeah. I think that based upon the success of the previous albums and the fact that the Carnegie Hall album really did sort of document a historic thing as far as a rock band is concerned, playing at such a prestigious venue in New York, Carnegie Hall, for a solid week, selling it out, courting, and also able to sort of include in the box of records that resulted, posters and information and lyrics and all that sort of thing. It was really kind of a it sort of created the idea of a box set.
It was a collection. Yeah, it was fabulous. I mean, it was a great collector's copy.
Yeah.
Chicago 5, best remembered for Saturday in the Park, inspired by you seeing all these talented musicians throughout Central Park in New York. So even the albums had some inspiration behind them.
Well, the music doesn't come magically from nowhere, at least for me. I read a lot. I I look at art a lot. I love films. I like watching cinema, and you know, all of that filters into if not the music, although that definitely occurs because I listen to a lot of music all the time. But all of that is the grist, if you will, of where the music comes from.
It wasn't until Chicago 7 that you were only going to release single albums because of the changes in the music industry, and I'm sure over 5 decades you've seen a ton of changes in this industry. But, you know, Columbia said, you know, and the labels, we're only going to pay for the 10 copyrights per record, no matter how many songs are on the record. And you figured at that point, you know what, we're going to put out some single albums.
Honestly, I didn't understand anything about the business of it. So as far as the copyrights or the number of copyrights or the limitation of the number of copyrights, at the time, I didn't understand it. I was always more concerned with just writing the music.
About the music itself. And you were touring so much. You guys were on the road nonstop. Did you prefer massive venues over smaller ones? Do you like the intimacy? Do you like the big crowds? Like, what really kind of motivates you when you're playing?
I like a variety, and happily that's kind of been our world for the last couple decades, where, you know, we'll play a beautiful, you know, 2,500 seat opera house one night, and we'll play an arena the next night, and it's definitely a different sort of performance. I mean, the music is the same, but obviously in an arena, it's a bigger place, and it's a bigger feeling. It's much more sort of physically dynamic than, say, playing in a Carnegie Hall, for instance, where it's there's more of a microscope sort of on the performances. We've come across that in our performances with symphonies, where it's a very, very different and, it, to a certain degree, much more musical experience, and it's a different type of performance. We like all of it.
That's cool. Yeah, that's very cool. All right, stick around. More with Robert Lamb of the band Chicago next on 720 WGN.
Couldn't stand to be kept away just for the day from your body. Wouldn't want to be swept away far away.
It's Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to Robert Lamb, co-founder of the rock and roll band Chicago, and his upcoming induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Fast forward to the 80s, you moved down to Warner Brothers. David Foster took a hand in helping making the Chicago 16, co-writing 8 of the album's 10 songs, including Hard to Say I'm Sorry, which became a worldwide number one single when the album was released. The album went to the top 10, sold 1 million copies. The next was Chicago 17 and 84 with Stay the Night, Hard Habit to Break, You're the Inspiration, Along Comes a Woman. A whole new generation of fans at that time, just, you know, over a decade later, discovered what Chicago was all about.
I think that's true, and as a result of our continuing to tour around the world and having the luxury of a large repertoire, as we played and performed, I think that audience that perhaps first discovered Chicago with Chicago 16 and 17 went back and looked through
right.
the catalog.
They did.
They went back and looked at their older siblings' vinyl collection.
I got to tell you, that's what I did. Because, I mean, I was born in 67, so I had to go back and do that. But I loved it. It was like a, wow, this is a pretty damn cool group, man. I mean, they've got a lot of history.
We still get comments like that all the time.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. And I know throughout the years, you know, you've had to replace band members. I mean, you're a staple. You've been with them since the beginning, founder of the band. How difficult is that task? I mean, when you're talking about singers, guitarists, I mean, there's been tragedy with the band and finding a new drummer. And I mean, all of this has to be difficult because you always want to maintain that sound.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky for sure, because it's not just the ability of the musicians that is important. It's the personality. Does the new guy travel well? Is he mature enough to take criticism when necessary? Is he mature enough to speak up? Mature enough to contribute?
Or handle the fame, for that matter.
Exactly. It sounds like there were a lot of guys in and out of the band, and frankly, we've only had two drummers, and we've had maybe three different guitar players, or maybe we're on our fourth now. I don't know, but other than replacing, once the '80s began, everything became keyboards, so we had to have a second keyboard player at some point. And Lou Pardini, who's been in the band now for at least 5 years, has been such a great addition to the band. So, but again, going back to what we look for basically good, solid people, just basically nice people. And of course, the music requires a certain amount of respect when it's played. To a certain degree, it's almost addressed as if it were classical music, mm-hmm. Especially the extended pieces like Jimmy Pankow's Ballet for a Girl in Buchanan, which we play every night, but it needs to be played with commitment and intensity every single night, but it has to be played right. So all of that stuff comes into play as the personnel in the band has shifted from time to time.
You talk about the long versions of these songs that you play. I know radio stations over the years have edited songs, especially in the 1980s, and they did that to your songs. Did that bother you?
It did for a minute. But I think that when you're a young rock star, you probably aren't particularly mature enough to understand the limitations of the business of radio.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, as we got older, we began to understand it. But I think overall we were grateful that anything got played off of any of those albums ever. So
there was good things with that. You were on tour with so many different groups too. I saw you on tour. First time I saw you guys live was '89. You were with the Beach Boys.
Oh, yeah.
That must have been a fun experience being with those.
That was great.
Yeah.
That was one of those deals where Beach Boys, as much as the Beatles, were so dominant in the culture, listening to them play their repertoire night after night and joining in with them was such a thrill. And I became lifelong friends with Carl Wilson and also Brian Wilson. That's one of the lovely things about
sure.
the community of musicians is that there is mutual respect and sometimes friendship blooms.
Sure. Oh, I bet. You guys have done big band albums. You've done holiday records, more live records. Your songs have been featured in the biggest movies, TV shows like The Sopranos, nonstop touring, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Doobie Brothers, Springsteen opened for you. You remember that guy in the early... early 1970s.
I do.
That's a pretty good combination to do that. But 50 years, almost 40 albums later, what song, what album at this stage means the most to you, Robert?
Well, an awful lot of the performances have always included the first album. That's an album that not only our first fans were exposed to, but it's one that is constantly played. And even the youngest fans I see them hold up the album cover, mm-hmm. the vinyl cover.
That's cool.
At the concerts.
Hey, vinyl's back. I mean, vinyl's back and bigger than ever.
Oh, in a big way.
Yeah.
Between vinyl and streaming, it's a whole new world.
It is. It is. Well, I was going to say, what is the biggest change in the music industry? Have you recognized
streaming?
Yeah.
Yeah. I constantly read about it in various magazines and newspapers. I think streaming is the biggest part of how people listen to music. And actually, I just went into my website, a couple of websites where my solo music is sold,
mm-hmm.
and I just really had to kind of update the formats that are available. So now I'm primarily streaming music. So there you go.
You know, I'm 48. I still love touching, holding, feeling something, and I guess I don't buy CDs as much as I will buy vinyl.
Yeah.
No. And put it on.
Well, I was told by the younger of my daughters that many times their friends will buy vinyl, but they still play CDs, but they put the vinyl up on the wall like
oh,
a piece of art.
Yeah. Which a lot of your album covers are pieces of art. They really are.
They really are.
Long time coming. The announcement came that you're inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame along with Cheap Trick, Deep Purple, and W.A. Steve Miller. Congratulations. This induction must mean a lot to you.
Well, yes. It's really kind of a nod of respect from our peers. Frankly, even though we were eligible sometime during the 90s, I believe, and we were, I guess, puzzled that we hadn't been invited into the hall sooner.
We believe that as well. I think everyone thinks about that.
But in the big picture, it was more important and has been more important that we continue to be creative and continue to perform all over the world. So as I've said before, I'd rather be working than sitting around being honored for lifetime achievements or whatever. So we're very grateful to have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. We're really looking forward to our performance in New York. I guess it's next week sometime.
Yep, April 8th.
I don't know exactly who is going to induct us, and I don't know exactly how the performance is going to go, but there's some discussion about closing the whole jam with 25 or 6 to 4.
Wow.
By the NWA to see if they can do some freestyle rap over that.
That's cool. Very cool. Well, looking forward to that. And again, congratulations on a long time coming induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. All happening this Friday night, April 8th, and you can find out more about that at rockhall.com. For more on Chicago, you can follow Robert on Facebook, Twitter, robertlamb.com. Visit chicagotheband.com. And I got to tell you, Robert, a thrill spending some time with you looking back at 50 years of Chicago. And again, congratulations on the long-awaited induction into the Hall of Fame.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to speak with you.
Thank you, sir. All right, we'll be back after this on 720 WGN.